discussion of exile and exodus, I guess. And last week we spoke about the reasons for exile, and today we're going to continue discussing Jews in exile. And the appropriate way to do this, I believe, is to look at the two biblical stories that describe the Jew in exile. And the first story we're going to look at is the story of Yosef. Now, much of what I'm going to say today is based on a book called Days of Deliverance, which is written by Rev Soloveitchik. And the title of his essay is Yosef and Hanukkah. Okay, we're obviously not going to discuss Hanukkah now, but we are going to discuss the Yosef story. Now, sometimes when you grow up learning a story, sometimes you miss, perhaps, how many questions there really are in that story, because we take it for granted, because we're learning it since we're 5 and 6. And the Rav says, if you look at the Yosef story is absurd. He says, let's think about it for a minute. He says, let's think about some very simple questions. He said, you don't have to be there's source sheets up here for those of you who came in late. You don't have to be a fantastic parent to know that you don't favor a child. That's something that somebody shouldn't have to teach you. That's something that you should know. So what in the world was Yaakov doing when he was giving Yosef the ketonet pasen? Secondly, I don't care how much you don't get along with your brother. You don't sell your brother into slavery as the preferred method of not killing him.
I'm sorry, I disagree with that last statement.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know what went on in your family. Okay.
In addition.
Yeah, that's true. Let's have no accepted. Question number three that the Rav asks, he says, and even if it is that way, Yaakov knows that the brothers don't like him. Why does Yaakov send him out to go find out their welfare in Shechem? Send somebody else. You have a house full of slaves. Send them. Why do you send the brother who you know they don't like? Finally, in addition, Reuven, he says, Reuven says he's going to save Yosef. He says, throw him into the pit and then I'll take him out. But then when they sell Yosef, where is Reuven? He's not there. Why isn't he there? Where's he going to? He's going to his father. It's a well-known Rashi that he's going to take care of his father. Wouldn't he be better served staying with his safe? Wouldn't that be a better thing for his father had he saved Yosef than going to help him, I don't know, do the dishes? Okay. See, and see, when you start thinking about it, and finally the whole Yehuda's whole story here is also problematic. So when the Rav starts looking at this story, he takes a step back and he says, there has to be more to this story than we are accustomed to looking at. And he says the whole story actually revolves around source number three. Source number three. Source number three is the pasuk in Bereishit, and it should say Bereishit Lamed Zayin. Vayimtzaehu ish v'hinei to'eh basadeh. And a man found Yosef, and behold, Yosef was lost in the field. Vayishalehu ha'ish lemar, ma tivakesh. And this man says to him, what are you doing? What are you looking for? Now, a number of times throughout, actually, the Parshiot, we have a mysterious man who appears, and he plays an important role in the moving things along in the story. Let's just take a look at some of those other verses and we'll come back. Look back at source number two. Another verse that you're all familiar with. Yaakov is left alone. Vayivater Yaakov levado. Vayaveik ish imo. Source number two. After the chart. We'll come back to the chart. All the sources start after. Okay, do you see it there? And here too, Yaakov is fighting with a mysterious man. Who is this man? Why is he important? And then you'll notice source 4, 5, and 6. When the brothers meet up with Yosef, and they don't know that it's Yosef, they refer to Yosef, why don't they refer to him as the king? Why don't we refer to him as second to Paro? They always refer to him as Diber Ha'ish. This man spoke to us, and he, in source 4, and he accused us of being spies. But Diber Ha'ish Adonai Ha'aretz. Yes, go ahead. You did it. We're good.
Okay, so okay. I just wanted to say happy birthday to Val. It's Val's 90th birthday, and Val has been in Matan for many, many years, and we're so happy to see you here, well, and studying, and we all wish you many, many years of happiness and learning and growth, and we want to thank all of the friends here that have dedicated this shiur to you, and we wish you well. Sorry.
So, it does call him Ish Adonai Ha'aretz, the Lord of the Land. But so, just call him Lord of the Land. Why do I need that Ish? And then, Pasuk, the next source 5, Yehuda also says to his father, He'ed Ha'id Banu Ha'ish. This man warned us. And finally, in source 6, source 7 also, when Yaakov says to them, go bring the man some produce, v'horidu l'ish mincha, bring him a present, and v'etachichem kechu, finally says, take Binyamin, v'kamu v'shuvu el ha'ish. So the Rav says that throughout these stories, this ish is a main character, but there's a certain amount of mystery connected to him. And if we go back specifically to source number 3, our story of Yosef, who is this man? It is a well-known medrash that appears in source number 8 that Rashi brings. Rashi in source number 8 is the Rashi in Breishit, where he says, Vayimtza'uhu ish zeh Gavriel. That who is this mysterious man? This mysterious man is the angel Gavriel. Now, what does that mean, that he is the angel Gavriel? According to the Rav, it means that this is the unique destiny of the Jewish people. And whether this man who meets him is a real angel, or whether this man is actually just a tool in God's hands, I don't think it matters, because either way, that person is a messenger of God. And what was it that God wanted? What is it that God wanted? The Jews had to go down to Egypt.
But I'm not in the story of Yosef.
Oh, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. 1 second. We'll get to that in a second. Hold on. But at the first Ish that we meet, the angel Gavriel, is a tool in God's hands. Yosef comes to the field. He's looking for his brothers. His brothers aren't there. What should he logically do? Go home. Go home. End of story. But God can't have Yosef go home. Yosef has to meet his brothers. He has to go down to Egypt because that's part of God's plan. So the Ish and the referral of Ish, according to the Rav, of this mysterious Ish, is the role of Jewish destiny. Now, he explains that basically there are 3 ways that God manifests his will in the world. The first way is where God does everything himself. You humans sit at the side. You are just observers in the situation, and God does everything on his own. Obviously, the classic example of that is probably creation, where nobody else helped God. This is something God does on his own. The second way God functions in this world, according to the Rav, is that he has a prophet. And the job of the prophet is to explain to humanity what God's role is, and perhaps explain to humans what God expects of them. And he sort of really just acts as this shaliach of God. Here, the classic example of this would probably be Eliyahu, Moshe, right, the major prophets that you can think of. And finally, there's a third way, and this perhaps is the way that most of us are most familiar with. And that third way is where God gives humanity over to, he gives them the choices. And he allows man to initiate and take part with him in moving history forward. Now, God has an ultimate goal. Something needs to be achieved. But there are many different tracks that humanity can take to get to that role, and that is where God allows humans to take that, to make those decisions. God wants to participate in this decision. But when man participates, it's not always easy. And with that participation, many times comes personal sacrifice, personal suffering that takes in order to move this process forward. The Rav points out that there are two blessings that we say in the morning. There's Hanotein Layaef Koach, and there's also Ozer Yisrael Bigvura. What is the difference between Koach and Gvura? Koach, he says, is a courageous action. Gvura is a heroic action. Now, what's the difference between courage and hero? Courageous is not necessarily heroic. And courageous, the Rav says, is exactly what we're describing here. It's an action that man thinks about and then executes. Heroic, according to the Rav, comes with a price.
What?
Comes with a price. There's a sacrifice there that needs to happen, and without sacrifice, you might be courageous and successful, but you don't heroic. Now let's go back to Yosef. According to the Rav, Yosef fits into which of these three categories? The God doing himself, the messenger, or the initiative? The initiative. That's correct. The Rav comes along and says Yosef is not, on one hand, he has that ability to take the initiative and make plans. Think about it. When Paro asks him to interpret the dreams, he could have just left it as it was. He didn't have to say to Paro, this is what you should do in order that there shouldn't be sacrifice. He takes that initiative and makes that suggestion to Paro. But with his initiative comes a tremendous amount of sacrifice. There is a price to be paid for this privilege of being God's partner. Now, if you look at Source 9, and this is going to prove what we're saying. If you look at Source 9, and you have it in Hebrew and in English, 9 in Hebrew, 9a in English, the Bereshit Rabbah is talking about the necessity for Yaakov to come down to Egypt. And basically the Medrash says there were two ways to bring Yaakov down. As we would say in Little English, you can do it the easy way, or we can do it the hard way. What is Yaakov like? He's like a cow being led to the slaughterhouse that refused to be drawn there. The cow was smart enough to know what's going on. What do they do to the cow? They lead her calf before her, and she walks after it against her will and against her interests. Likewise, Yaakov should rightfully have been led down to Egypt in chains and a collar. But the Holy One, blessed be He, said, He is my firstborn Yaakov, and I should take him down in shame and humiliation. Instead, I shall lead his son before him. He will follow him against his will and against his interests. Okay? So he's going to go down the other way. Yaakov's going down is smooth and painless in his mind because he's going to be reunited with Yosef. But had he not gone plan A, plan B would have taken Yaakov down, perhaps as a prisoner as well. In spite of all the successes that Yosef had, Yosef is really a tragic figure. First of all, it cannot be very pleasant to be on the receiving side of the hatred of your family. He was sold as a slave for 13 years before he becomes second to the king. He's a slave. He ends up in jail. And even when he rises to power, he's still the other. He's still the other. And if you look at source 10, there's a pasuk in Bereishit that describes, then he's bringing the brothers coming up and how everybody's eating. The pasuk tells us that even though he's Mishneh LeMelech, he's the prime minister, and still the Egyptians are not willing to sit at the same table and eat with him. Because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews because it is an abomination to the Egyptians. So we understand that feeling of loneliness that must have Yosef must have experienced. So everything we've said up till now. So why does this story, we said the Rav says the story is absurd. He says the story is absurd, and all those little pieces that happen have to happen in order for Yosef to go down to Mitzrayim. Yosef needs to go down to Mitzrayim in order to bring Yaakov down to Mitzrayim in order to fulfill what? The Brit Ben Abatarim. In order to fulfill the Brit that God made, where he said, know that your children will be strangers in the land that is not theirs for 400 years, and there they will suffer and they will be in servitude. When God makes, what is a Brit? A Brit is a covenant. So at this point, you know, the Rav has a theory that he develops in many of his books, which he calls the covenantal community. Those people who made a covenant with God. And he says, the fact that the Jews can have a covenant with God when they're living in their land, yeah, is obvious. He says, what happens when the covenantal community is forced to leave their homeland? And in essence, Yosef is really not the first one to leave, but Yaakov is the first one to leave. Yaakov leaves the land and he goes to exile in Laban's house. What kind of exile does he experience there? It's not a good one. It's not a pleasant one. Laban is always trying to trick him. He's always trying to take advantage of him. He's always trying, you know, he's not looking to see what it is that he can do. And we know a very famous, another Rashi that we have in source 11 and 11a, when Yaakov is coming back from that exile, he sends messengers to Esav. Vayitzaveh otam lemor, and he says to these messengers, Ko tomun ladoni leesav. This is what you should say to Esav. Ko amar avdecha Yaakov, im Lavan garti. I lived with Lavan. And a very famous Rashi, we'll get to the second part, the Devar Acher. Why does he choose the word, I lived with Garti? There are many other words for living, like Lishkon Shama, but Rashi says, Im Lavan Garti, the word Garti has the same gematria as the word Taryag, the same letters, Taryag Mitzvot Shamarti. That even though I was in exile, I still was able to keep that covenant with God. So Yaakov is the first one who's able to show that the covenant of God is one that is beyond location, and it lasts everywhere, especially in a difficult society. And Yaakov was able to prove that you can maintain your Jewish identity even in a hostile environment. Then we come to Yosef. If Yaakov has proved that you can keep your Jewish identity in a hostile environment, what is Yosef's role? Yosef's role is to prove that you can keep that covenant in a comfortable exile. You can become second to the king and still maintain your Jewish identity. And we see Yosef maintaining his Jewish identity because throughout his conversations, one of the things that personifies Yosef is anything that they say, Yosef, thank you for interpreting the dreams. Yosef says, it's from God. When the brothers come down and they're so upset that they sold him, he says, it wasn't you, it was God. He keeps bringing God into that, and he is able to maintain this covenant. So according to Rav, the whole story of Yaakov and Yosef is to show that we can maintain this covenant regardless of where we are. And that Yosef is the one who keeps the covenant in a comfortable position because he's the one who brings God into everything he does.
When we say comfortable, he's in Egypt.
He was in Egypt, but when he becomes second to the king, think about
it.
He's still separate, we say the same thing, but he has all the wealth that he could possibly want, all the power that he could possibly want. And let me just make a point here. The Rav makes that point. He throws it out, which I'll obviously throw out to you. He says, the Rav lived in America recently in Boston. He says, today, the Jew in America has never been freer, has never been wealthier, has never been more successful and prominent, but are we Jewish Americans being successful in maintaining that covenant? So leave that as that. Let's move on now. So that is the very beginning of the Jewish nation. When we move now to Esther, at the very end of the biblical books, we see that Esther, and what is unique about the book of Esther, is that it actually defines a new time in Jewish history. The Jews are no longer a nation in their land. Now, we're so used to living in exile because we're living in exile 2,000 years. Remember at that time, the people didn't believe that the temple was going to be destroyed. They didn't believe it. When Yirmiyahu came and said, they weren't willing to believe it. Once the temple was destroyed and they go to exile, many of them thought that that's it. We're never getting out of it. Right? All of this is a new experience to them. And one of the ideas of Esther, as you know, is that there is no longer revelation. There is no longer a prophet. Now, the reason for that is a very practical one. The Jews are spread out over 127 nations. There's no smartphones. If there's a prophet in one nation, how is the word going to get out to all the others? So for a very practical reason, there is no revelation. So that on one hand, we're going to say that Esther is living in a new reality, but on the other hand, we're going to see that it really isn't a new reality. It's a new place and a new monarch, but the story is not necessarily different. What's unique about Esther is that until Esther, when God wanted mankind, he pursued mankind. How did he pursue mankind? With the prophets, with the open miracles in the temple. God was in human's face. When the Jews go into exile, God is no longer pursuing man. If man wants to find God, he has to pursue God. What is one of the major issues in the book of Esther? The fact that God's name is not there. And now we understand why God's name is not there, because humanity has to seek out God, and that's why you all know Esther comes from what root word? Hester, the hidden face of God. Esther is compared to the Ayelet HaShachar. Esther is compared to the dawn. And you have this in source 14 and 15. Let's do 15 first. Amar Reb Asi, Lama Nimshala Esther L'Shachar. Now, let me just give you a little... When is Esther compared to the Shachar? It's the Perek in Tehillim, Mizmor Shir L'Ayelet HaShachar. I think it's 22. And the Medrash says there, who is the Ayelet HaShachar? That is Esther. And those of you who were with us over the semester, we spent a whole share comparing that chapter to the Megillah. But why is she called Esther? Lomar Lach, Ma Shachar Sof HaLaila. The dawn is the end of the night. Ach Esther Sof Kol HaNisim. She too is the end of all the miracles. Why is she the end of miracles? Because what's a miracle? A miracle is God in your face. God is no longer in your face anymore, so you're not going to have those outside miracles. But what's unique? They were not outside miracles. The type of miracles we have, we switch into miracles that are hidden. The hidden miracles. The miracles that occur through nature. Esther in Persian means
star.
Esther in Persian means star. Why is she being called star? Because where is the light coming from in that exile? From humanity. And that's the difference. Go back to what the Rav said about Yosef, and we see Esther and Mordechai as being primary examples of this. They have to take initiative. And without that human initiative, the whole story of Esther would not have happened.
Power of dreams was emerging.
That's right. Power.
King's dreams and Mordecai also.
We're going to talk about those parables in one second. We'll talk about those parables. Hold off with that for a second. Okay? So we just understand, that where do we see the initiative of Esther and Mordecai? So first of all, I think the easiest initiative is, you know, that there's a biblical commandment that you're not allowed to add anything to the mitzvot. Baal Tosis. What did Esther and Mordecai do? They added a holiday. The fast first on Pesach, and then they had a whole holiday afterwards. Also, the initiative that Esther is taken into the palace of Ahasuerus way before there is even a Haman. Why does she allow herself to be taken? Maybe it's something that she should have risked her life over. Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman. Why does he take that initiative? And the biggest initiative of Esther is when Mordechai says to her, you got to go to the king. Why didn't God make a miracle? Let the king call him. Call her. The king would have called him. We would have been good if God gets involved the way he does. So I think what we see here is the idea that God, just like by Yosef, God is giving over the scepter, so to say, to man, and he's saying to man, you have to take initiative. Man, you have to, and just the way we talked about Yosef as being that tragic hero, I think Esther is certainly, when you talk about the loneliness of Yosef, you know, you think about the loneliness that Esther must have felt living all those years in the palace. And Yoram Chazoni has a book called The Dawn, which is a fabulous book about Megillat Esther, and I understand that he's republished it in a new name, but I only have the old copy. And there he says that from the story of Esther, as opposed to the three ways of the Rav by Yosef, Chazoni says they're basically, we learn three different tracks that the Jew needs to take in order to succeed in exile. First of all, he needs to invest. Now, what does that mean that he needs to invest? Invest doesn't just mean you need to, like, be good citizens. Invest, according to Chazoni, means you need to really choose that you're going to work on behalf of the ruler. For instance, when Mordechai hears that Bigtan and Seresh want to kill him, what could he really have done?
Nothing.
No, he didn't have to do anything. That's right. And not only does he have to do anything, but when he tells the king, if Bigtan and Seresh had been successful, then he chose the wrong side. Okay? So you're saying that there is an investment that he's going to aid the king, and then, of course, obviously, once he is revealed, he becomes a major part of the king's entourage. The second step, according to Chazoni, that you need is what he calls boldness. Boldness. A certain amount of what we would call perhaps even chutzpah. That the Jew sometimes needs to stand up and take an action that is not necessarily the easy way out. And for that, of course, the example is Mordechai's refusal to bow down to Haman, his decision to go out in the street and cry in a loud voice wearing sackcloth, Esther's going to the king, all of that thing that we said before as initiative. And finally, the third step is what Chazoni says is faith. What does it mean when we say faith? That the absence of God's name is not supposed to make us afraid. We're not supposed to say he isn't there. Rather, he is there, but he is acting in a hidden sort of a way. And we see this because very clearly, and this pulled everything we've said together, Mordechai says to Esther, you don't want to go to the king? Fine, don't go to the king, but know that Something is going to happen. Revach vatzala yamod la yehudim makom haker. God's plan is going to happen. He's got to get to Egypt, either this way or that way. The Jews are going to be saved, either this way or that way. The question is all about what role you are going to play in that pattern of things. And that is what Mordechai says to Esther, and that is what Yosef says to the brothers when he reveals himself. He says, it's not really you, it's not, it all comes from God. So we see the interplay here of the first Yosef in exile and Esther in exile. But I want you to see here, and this is what we'll go into now, is that there is much more overlap between these two stories when you start thinking about it. So let's start first talking about the ideas in a big role. What parallel ideas do you see between the story of Esther and the story of Yosef? So let's get thinking. So actually they both talk about Jews in exile. They both have a hero. They both have a hero who happens to be a Jewish hero. Okay. They both have a dictator, okay, who, as an ancient world dictators go. Okay. What else do they have? They, what? The story comes of a involvement of a palace. What else? Correct. We're going to come to that in a minute. I'm going to come back to them when I compare the two individually. Now I just want to do the general idea and we're going to come back to that point. Okay? They both both are heroes. You know, have a tremendous amount of power. They are loyal to the government that they are involved in. They are, in both our situations, this is interesting, we have the cure, what we say in Hebrew, the refuah lefnei hamakah, the cure before the disease. In what way? Yosef is king before the famine, Esther is in the palace before Haman. In both of our stories, well, we'll get there is a revelation, there is a hidden identity, and a revelation, but we'll come to that in a minute. Let's just say, in terms of ideas, the last idea I want to bring, which I think is the probably the most important idea, how does the Yosef story develop?
Naturally.
Not naturally, and what happens? The brothers come down, and then what happens? He reveals himself, and then?
Well,
you know, when they come down, they reveal himself.
The exile continues.
And not only does exile continue, but it gets worse. What happens at the end of Book of Esther? Okay. Both stories begin in an exile and end. There's no happy ending. Okay, there's no happy ending to these stories. So that's in a theory. Let's go down more, as you said specifically. Let's specifically go now to compare Yosef to Esther. So the first comparison we had is that Yosef and Esther are both described as good-looking, and it's not only a coincidence that they're good-looking, but their looks play an important critical part in moving the story along. What other similarities are there between Yosef and Esther?
Both of them have lost their mother.
Both are motherless. Correct. Both are motherless. But let's take that even a step further. Both are motherless, and they both come, though, from who is their mother? Descendants, right. They're both descendants, Rachel. Okay, so that they do that mother. Okay, what else? What else do you see between the two of them?
They suffered.
They're both suffering. They're both, we talked about the loneliness. I can't spell. You'll get it. The loneliness. Okay. L-O-N-E-I. Okay. The loneliness that they both experience. What else?
They both live in
palaces. Okay. Oh, so we have the palace living there. Right, they're in loneliness, but let's say they're living luxury, perhaps we'll say that.
Luxurious loneliness.
Okay. Okay, now this is interesting. They keep up their Judaism, but yet both of them have a hidden identity. Right? Right? They brothers don't know that Yosef is Yosef. Ahasuerus doesn't know that Esther is. And as part of their hidden identity, both of them have a dual name. Esther is known as Hadassah. Yosef is known as Satapaneach Avrech. So they both have this dual identity, which is hidden, which gets revealed, right? At a certain point in the story, which becomes a turning point of the story. Okay, let's continue, and I'm going to erase that point, because we're continue. Once we continue with Yosef and Esther, let's continue now with Yosef and Mordechai. What's the comparison between Yosef and Mordechai?
Resistance to the king.
They both become Mishneh LeMelech. Right, they both play, both of them play that same role at the end of the story. And in order to become Mishneh LeMelech, in ancient times, what do you get? The ring. Both of them get that ring from the king as a symbol of that. What else? Correct. Okay, well, we're going to get to the dreams when I do Paro and... But you're right, dreams play an important role in both stories, but we'll come back to that. We're talking about specifically Yosef and Mordechai. I think that one of the major issues here is also neither of them are able to be swayed. Why? What happens, right? They're staunch in their beliefs. Yosef, right, it says every day that Mrs. Potiphar comes and tries to get him, and it says that he refuses, and the nation says to Mordechai on a regular basis, bow down, and he refuses. So they're both strong in their strength, in their convictions, and I think finally, also, the last thing I want to say about Yosef and Mordechai is that both of them have a good deed that gets forgotten. There's a good deed that gets forgotten, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, Yosef says, interprets the dreams and specifically says that Tzvah HaMashkim forgets, Mordechai saves the king, and he forgets. Let's continue in our comparison. This time let's compare Ahasuerus to Paro. Okay, when we compare Ahasuerus to Paro, so somebody already said and pointed out, let's come back to that, both of them, their dreams play a role, or let's not call it dreams, rather perhaps the more correct term is sleep. Sleep, the lack of it, or right, the ability to sleep here plays a role in both stories. What else?
Both are heavily dependent upon a multitude of advisors.
Okay. Both of them seem to have a decision making issue. Okay. On one hand, it shows a certain amount of weakness, but on the same time, we have this idea that they are dictators with everything that goes along with that. What else?
They like parties.
Both of them have parties. Correct. What party does Paro have? His birthday, that's right. Paro has a birthday party, and it says clearly that in the verse. And finally, they both have also disloyal servants. Now I want to show you something interesting about these disloyal servants. If you take a look here, well, we'll come back to, let's do it now. If you look at source 17, okay. Actually, let's start with 18 first, and we'll go back to 17 in a minute. 18 and 19 are the very similar source, okay? But one's from the Gemara in Megillah, and the other is from the Midrash. But we'll even do 19, because that's the easy one. L'chu u'ru'u mifalot Elohim nora alila al b'nei Adam. Look how wondrous God is. He always has a plan greater than humans. Mektzif adonim al adonehem, al avadehem. He makes a king get angry at his servants. That's Paro getting angry at the Sar HaMashkim and the Sar HaOfim. Kidei liten gedula letzadik, in order to get Yosef out. Paro katzaf al avadav. And by the way, both of the avadim are called tzrisim. I'll show you that in a minute. Umaktzif avadim al adonehem. And then he gets servants to rise up against the king, that's Bigson and Seresh, in order to go up against Paro, litein gedula letzadik, in order to give Mordechai greatness. So in other words, here the Medrash is saying this is not necessarily a coincidence that they have these disloyal servants, but these servants are actually part of this plan that we are discussing. Now, who are the servants in the Paro story? No, in the Paro story. The baker and the record. Right, we have this, what we call the Sar HaMashkim and the Sar HaOfim. Right, whether it's the Sar or the servant, whatever. Okay. Who are our sinners, so to speak, in the Mordechai story? We have Bigtan and Seresh. No, it doesn't work. Okay, we have Bigtan and Seresh. Let's start with Seresh. What's the root of this word? Tirosh. What's Tirosh? Right. You all know the brand here in Israel is called Tirosh. Tirosh is wine. So we have a Sar HaMashkim who sins against Paro, and we have a Teresh who goes against Sar HaOfim. What's Bag? Anybody? Take a look here in source number, I brought a few at the end, source 21. Source number 21 is a pasuk from Daniel. In Daniel, Daniel and his friends are living in exile, and in order to maintain their identity, they refuse to eat the king's bread. What is the king's bread called in Daniel?
Patbag.
It's called patbag. So in other words, the Sar HaOfim, the baker, parallels Bigtan. The Sar HaMashkim parallels Teresh. And now go back to source 17. It's a source, I'm going to change the way you've been learning the story your whole life. Source number 17 tells us, it's Targum Yonatan in Breishit, and it's in Aramaic, but if you look in the parentheses, I wrote it for you in Hebrew. Vayhi achar hadrim ha'ela, vayomu lemar chatas sar ha'mashkim. Amar lemelch mitrayim v'sar ha'ofim, vayitja'atsu lahatil sam ha'mavet b'ma'achalo. It's not like we learned when we were in kindergarten that there was a rock in the bread and a fly in the wine. Targum Yonatan says they had intention of poisoning him. This was not just a fluke thing. This, and why do you think Targum Yonatan says this? I think Targum Yonatan says this because he looks at the parallels of the two stories, and that is what they tried to do. So we have disloyal servants who are almost the same, and they want to accomplish the same thing. Now, it's not only a parallel in ideas that we see, we also have a very strong parallel in the language. Now, before we do this, I want you to see that this is just, I'm not making this up, that this is actually appears in the Midrash, and look at source 20. Source 20 says, Rabbi Yochanan in the name of Rabbi Binyamin bar Rabbi Levi. The children of Rachel experience similar challenges and rise to the similar prominence. Their challenges are similar, as we find written, and now she spoke to Yosef day after day, and here it's written, and they spoke to him day after day. I'll show you this in a minute. Let's not go through the rest of them, but I want you to see that the Medrash does bring this. Now turn to the first page. On the first page, you have a chart. Well, on the right-hand chart, you have the story of Yosef. On the left-hand chart, you have Megillat Esther. Let's go through these quickly. Vayakov, it says, and Yaakov ripped his garments, Vayikra Yaakov simlotav, Vayisem sak. In the Esther story, we have Vayikra Mordechai, Bigadav, Vayilbash, sak. Same idea, same terminology. As you pointed out, Vayhi Yosef, Yifat Toar, Vyifat Mar'eh. And by Esther, we have Hanara, Yifat Toar, Vyifat Mar'eh. Not only both good looking, but it's the exact same terminology. Then we have number three. As we, this is the one we just pointed out in the Medrash. Vayhi kidabra el Yosef yom yom velo shama aleha. And she, Mrs. Potiphar, spoke to Yosef every day and he didn't listen to her. And by Esther, by Mordechai, it says, Vayhi kamram elav yom yom velo shama alehem. It's almost identical. Continuing, Vayiksof paro al shnei sarisav, the disloyal servants. It says that he got angry on these two and specifically calls them sarisim. In Megillat Esther, Bayimim Ha'em, Katzaf, there's the word again, big son Viteresh, shnei sarisei hamelech. Also, the next one is that the party is on the third day, and what is Ahasuerus's party? The third year. Now, this one is interesting. The next, yeah.
One of my sons in law, the whole family, do not celebrate
birthdays. Yes, I've heard that, but, yeah, because of that. Let's continue into the next source. It says, Vayifka. She says that to my father. My father used to joke like that too. Alav HaShalom used to say, you want a birthday party? You want to be like Paro? My father had that routine too, but he let us have parties. Anyway, Vayifkod, Vayifkod Pekidim Al Haaretz. And Paro puts out overseers in the land in order to gather up the food. Vayikabtsu et kol ha'ochel. Now what does it say in Esther? Vayifaked ha'melech pekidim vayikabtsu. But what are they gathering in Mitzrayim? They're gathering food. What are they gathering in Persia? Girls. But which just told you that in Persia they're looking at the women the same way they're looking at the grain in Egypt. That's just a small point. Anyway, continuing. Hala. When Paro removes his ring, right? We have almost the exact same words twice. Once when he gives it to Haman, and once when he gives it to Mordechai. Then we have, when Yosef becomes appointed the Mishnah Lamelech, Vayilbash oto bigdei sheish, Vayukav oto b'markevet, Vayikra lefanav. When Haman comes at night and Ahasuerus says, what should we do to the man we want to honor? He said, Yavo bilvush machut, dress him up, Herkivuhu al hasus, put him on here it's a merkava, there's it's a sus, the same idea, Vikaru lefanav, and call before him. When Yaakov finds out, he says, if he doesn't come home, Binyamin, Vashir Vani, Kasher Shakalti, I will be bereaved. Here Esther says, Vakasher Avaditi, Avaditi, not the same words, but the same term. And Ki Eich Ela Elavi, Yosef, Yehuda says, how can I go back to my father? Pen Ereb Bira'a Asher Yimatse Etavi, when I see the evil that will become my father. And Ki Eichacha, or Esther says, Ki Eichacha Uchav Ra'iti Bira'a Asher Yimatse Et Ami. Same sentence. And I threw in the last one also again because of the comparison. In Egypt, that describes when they're embalming the dead Yaakov as making him into a mummy. That's how they made it. In Esther, what are they? Yimei maluim? The women. So they're comparing the women again to the, this time to the dead bodies. But I think from this comparison, it's clear to everybody that Megillat Esther was written with the story of Yosef in front of them. And it's not a coincidence that the same terminology is being used. So now we've come full circle, and we sort of have to try to understand here together in the last couple of minutes that are left to us, why? Why? So of course, biblical critics will tell you, well, they repeat the language because it's fun to read terminology that you're familiar with, and it remembers in your mind because you put it in the same folder, that kind of idea. But I think we need to look for something obviously deeper than that. Anybody have a nice suggestion?
Why the terminology?
Why the terminology? And the idea, the stories are the same. The story is the same.
It's always been done in literature to create a connection between what was and what is.
Right.
And to bring it forward. This is when you study literary theory.
Right. So this is right. So that's one way of approaching it. Say this is just part of literary theory. And that is a technique that is used quite often in many ideas. But I think here we have to look for a deeper meaning. But before we go any further, let's just point out, I think we have to make two major distinctions between these two stories. We talked about how much was comparable. What are the two major differences? So difference number one... Okay, well, but the we'll talk about that in a second. We'll come back to the exile point in a minute. But first of all, Yosef and his brothers, when they're in exile, they're really in exile as a family, as an individual per se. The Esther story is already the national. In addition, as we pointed out, the Yosef story has the name of God on a tremendous, all over the place. And the story of Esther, it doesn't. So right away, the comparison of the two stories is to tell you that the stories, even though they might not look the same because you don't see God's hand in them the same way, the stories really are parallel. And that it might seem that God is far away when you're a nation in exile, but look back to the story that parallels it, and the story is that God is there, and it is He who is manipulating the sleep, the lack of it, the dream, whatever it is. And sometimes there's Yosef there to tell you, and sometimes there's not there as a Yosef, but it is up to us to search it out and find it there as well. There, I think, is also...
What exactly was the time of Esther? Wasn't it around the time when people were already going down?
Yes,
they probably had an option of going back.
We're going to talk about that one more second. Hold off a second. The other point I want to make out, and one more point, is also the question of, as we started, this idea of survival in exile, and what are the roles of survival in exile, and different models of survival in exile. But as we pointed out, both of our stories don't necessarily have a happy ending. Both of our stories end in the Jews still being in exile, to the extent of the ability that also they're also under the concept of a dictator. And we all know this from Jewish history, that today life can be wonderful, and tomorrow morning, pack your bags, you're out of here. So that is one of the ideas here that we need to remember about exile. And perhaps, maybe that is the hidden message of these two stories, that survival alone in exile is guaranteed because of the Jewish people, God is going to keep them alive, and etc. And there are places even where the Jews are able to thrive and become second to the king. But ultimately, you're still in exile. And you're still strangers in a strange land. And that's what you need to remember about the comparisons of the story. That no matter how high you get, you're still in exile. And the only way to really guarantee your survival, the only way to really guarantee that you're going to thrive, is leaving the exile and returning home.